You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Andy Richter, and you have tuned in again to The Three Questions. I am the host, and this week we are delving into the archives, doing the best of here. And this week I am talking to one of my favorite people on the entire planet, a Mr. Jack Black. I talked to Jack back in July of 2022, and here is that conversation that I had with the truly great Jack Black.
I had some joints, and then my wife, I went out of town, and my wife hid my joints so that our sons would not find the joints. And when I was looking for my fancy tape recorder, I keep it in this case, I was like, something smells like joints. And it was, this is where she hid the joints and forgot that she hid my joints. I found my joints.
All right. Yay. Everything. This is,
oh my God.
See, this is such a happy reason to do a podcast now.
That's worth the price of admission right there.
Thank God your sons don't want a podcast. Let's put this where the podcasting machines are. They'll never find, you know, one time my son, his room was in the front of the house, and it's an old house, and like the mail slot would come through into like a cabinet built in his room. So, you know, like everybody had to go into his room to get the mail. And he and his boyfriend are laying in bed one morning, and I just kind of poke my head in because they're asleep to get the mail. Yeah. And right in front of where the mail slot is a gigantic bag of weed. It looked like a half ounce to me. And I just was like, he was awake, and I was like, just pretend to be intimidated by me. Pretend to be afraid of me. You know, like, don't leave it in the only place in the room where I have to go, you know?
Yeah. But isn't it better than secrets?
Kidding. Absolutely. I mean, it's no. And I mean, also too, my parents, you know, they didn't impose hypocrisy, you know? So it's like, my parents drank like fish. Like when they were teenagers, they drank cocktails. They didn't drink beer. They were drinking like Manhattans and Rob Roy's and shit I don't even know how to make. And so when my brother and I got, they're like, drink beer. Just, you know, be careful. If your friends are too drunk, they can't go home, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So,
yeah.
All right. On a podcast. Hi, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Does it bother you that I'm like unshowered?
No, not at all. I can't see
it. It doesn't matter, because really this is about the audio. No one's ever going to see my bed head.
No. I make the bed just for you. Like the bed that's behind me, I made it for you. I don't care about these people. They're not going to see this.
Are we already recording? Because
I'm
way behind. Okay,
this is
now I'm recording now, so I'm also recording our podcast.
All right, then we got the first part covered.
Well, what was it about show business that first grabbed you?
You know what?
Because you grew up out here. You grew up in L.A.
Well, this is getting dangerously close to the three questions.
That's the idea.
Okay, so here we go. We're going into phase one right now.
We are. We got the initial stuff over with.
I like to put the chapter headings when I see them coming up in neon lights. Chapter one, question number one.
Yes.
Where did Jack Black come from?
Yeah. What is Jack Black?
That my initial pull. Yes, the origin story, the pull to the industry. Well, my first memory of putting on a show was in the living room of our house in Hermosa Beach, California, just south of Los Angeles, just outside of Hollywood, but close enough.
Beachy.
That you could feel the energy. Beachy, yes.
Yeah.
But you could feel the energy of Hollywood, the machine, the center of the entertainment universe, right next door. And my parents were progressive aerospace engineers. They worked at TRW, and they were very smart, but they were also folk dancing, Middle Eastern folk dance enthusiasts. That's how they actually met.
Really?
They met folk dancing, and then I was like, I'm an aerospace engineer. What? Oh, my God, me too. Something
like married.
That.
Let's get married.
They got married, and it was a groovy time, you know, in the late 60s, and I was born in 69, and they moved to Hermosa Beach, California, and my earliest memory of putting on a show, we were in the living room. It was me, my mom and dad, and I wanted to recreate my birth. I think I must have been like 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah.
And I put a blanket over my mom, and I would come out of the blanket crying, and then I wanted them to play their part and be like, oh, a baby, we love you. Oh. It was very strange, but I really got a kick out of that recreation. And then that evolved, and I started doing a show for them, just for them. They were the only audience members where I am born, and then I grow up, and I have like a life as an adult, and then I die. I did my whole life for them, a one-man show.
Right, right.
And they just got such a kick out of it. They thought I was so funny, and I guess that was the beginning.
Yeah. How long was that? I mean, do you remember what your adult life was like in the one-man show? Like, what did you do in the one-man show?
It's very foggy.
Yeah.
There's a lot there. Yeah, I don't remember. I think that I graduated from school, and then I think I was driving a car. I don't think I had like
a job. Any,
yeah, I don't remember getting married or anything in my. Yeah, I wish that there was a tape of that very first Jack Black performance, but it's really lost in the sands of time.
Yeah,
I could call my dad and ask if he remembers any of it, but for sure his fog is thicker than mine.
Yeah, that's when I was a little kid, I avoided going to bed by doing Carol Burnett bits, recreating Carol Burnett bits for my grandma.
Yeah.
And she would become incapacitated with laughter.
Oh my God.
And it was like, that's just fucking power. Like when you,
dude, there's no more powerful, sense of confidence that you can get than when you're a kid doing it, trying it out for those early times when you're trying to put on a show. If you've got a family member or someone who's just loving your shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it can be overstated how much that can carry you through the rest of your life.
Yeah. And it is like, it's, you know, you don't want to look at it as being like completely transactional. You know, like, hey, if I do this, you're like, if I push this button, I get some candy. But it is kind of like, it still does sort of have that aspect, no matter how long you do it or in what venue. It is still kind of like, well, if I go do this, I get this good feeling, and you know, I like that good feeling, and you know, it's pretty fun to make people happy. It is, I have said before, it's the physical manifestation of happiness. Like, it's like in terms of like the short-term goal of like, or the, you know, like the very succinct goal of making people happy in life. Like they're making the noise that happiness is, you know, like you're making them make that noise. So,
well, it's like, you know, when you're very young, when is the first time you feel that pull to have a purpose, to have something that you are good at so that there is a meaning for you to exist?
Right.
That's what we're talking about. These are big, heavy things, you know, and when you first put on a show, there's that hope like, wait, maybe this is why I am. Maybe this is what I'm supposed to do. And if you have some success in that, just like in anything, if people like what you do, if you like you're a carpenter and you made some cool like little fort, that sense of accomplishment or a job well done is one of the most powerful things that a young mind and young person can have. And mine, yeah, was definitely from a very early age. It was putting on a show was a main thing. I mean, I had other stuff I liked to do. I like to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
and
I
you
got
still
a little,
draw a lot. Yeah,
I still draw. I got some love for that. But yeah, there was something about getting those giggles and those chortles that was extra special.
Did you ever bug your kids or bug your parents because you were, you know, in showbiz town, like to be a child actor of any kind? Like,
I remember, yeah, I was jealous of other kids. Like, there was one kid in particular who was in that movie Real Life by Albert Brooks. And I was like, oh man, if I could have that. And my stepfather, many years later, when I was like 10 years old, said he could drive me around to auditions if I wanted. I was like, yes, I do want that. And then he took me around. And so I did that circuit as a young child actor. Look, I have to confess, Andy, I was a child actor.
Oh,
okay?
No.
Are you happy? Now you know.
Now we know where the damage is from. Oh, I wish I could hug you.
I loved it. And I loved going on auditions. I really did. Even if I didn't get the part, if I got a laugh in the audition, I was just high all day. Yeah. And I'd go on auditions for commercials, everything. There was no pickiness. It was like anything and everything. And I got a commercial. That was my first professional paying job. And I got into the SAG union when I was, I think I was 12 years old. 1982. That would have been like the same year that Jeff Bridges was in Tron.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's how far back I go in the industry.
The ascendancy meets.
I also went on auditions for plays.
Yeah.
And I weirdly auditioned for a play called Inside Eddie Binstock. And it was in a coffee shop in Hollywood, a crack in the wall place called the Deja Vu Coffee House. Definitely not there anymore. And it was directed by a young, fresh out of UCLA, Tim Robbins.
What
who is the world famous Tim Robbins from Escape from the Prison movie that everyone loves.
Yeah, sure. Shaw Green Mile.
And the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
So anyway, he directed that, and I just looked up to him, and I was, you know, 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And I did that for a while, and then I did theater in high school, did a lot of musical theater. So that was like the beginnings of Tenacious D, is, you know, the mixture of music and comedy and theater. And then I went to UCLA. I was a theater major at UCLA. Not a good student.
Mm-hmm.
My parents didn't, you know, bribe anyone. There was there was definitely some strings were pulled. Because I did not deserve to be at UCLA, but I got into UCLA theater, and I slept through all of the lectures. I was kind of going through the motions because my dad really wanted me to have a diploma, so I had to try. And then I basically bailed on college, and I went off to do theater with the Actors Gang company, who was started by Tim Robbins, who I had this connection to from 10 years earlier when I was 12 years old. And we went to the Edinburgh Theatre Festival, and And that's where me and Kyle first met to start Tenacious D, my rock band, comedy band.
You met in Edinburgh or you met at the Actors Gang?
We met in the Actors Gang.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We were both in Edinburgh together. And yeah. So yeah, that's kind of what led to my first movie role was Tim's first movie that he directed called Bob Roberts.
That's the first place I remember seeing you. And I have
you saw my first role.
I did. And I remember like seeing you in that, you making an impression, and then seeing you in subsequent things and going, oh, that's that creepy guy from Bob Roberts. Cause you played you basically played like the precursor of all the fucking, you know, dead-eyed right-wing people on the internet now. Like, yeah. You know, young maniac, shaved head, Travis Bickle, you know, Republican guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before there was MAGA Nation.
Right, exactly.
I predicted it with my performance. Bob Roberts.
Do you think you caused it?
Bob Roberts could have been, that would be a cool one for Tim to do a sequel to Bob Roberts, because it seems a lot of that has come true in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
The manipulation of the religious right into, you know, crazy political power.
Yeah. I mean, do you have any regrets about skipping college? Like, do you wish you had? Like, is it going to be hard for you to tell your kids, you better go to college?
What would have happened in a sliding door universe where, you know, I do think sometimes what I coulda, woulda, shoulda done after high school when I graduated was not go straight into college.
Yeah.
Take a year off, travel, experience life in a different way, and then maybe go to college and really dive in head first with what I want to study. But then I realized, no, it's just actually not for me. Mm-hmm. And it started even before college. In high school, I had a real tough time, even in grade school, I had a real tough time concentrating, you know, back to the ADHD. And my mind would wander in class. And it was almost like I had narcolepsy in any kind of school environment. Whenever it felt like traditional education, I fell asleep, and I fell asleep all the time. And one time, the teacher at high school, I was at Crossroads School for the Arts and Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was in 11th grade. The teacher, the science teacher, chemistry, got so sick of me falling asleep in class, he told the whole class, everyone stay totally quiet. Now leave everyone, because the class is over. Instead of everyone getting up and loudly leaving, everyone left the classroom super quiet. So I was still sleeping on the desk, and then he told everyone coming in for the next class, everyone come in quiet, Jack's asleep and I want to surprise him. So everyone came in and sat down, and the class started, and at some point I like woke up and looked around, and I was confused because I didn't, I'm not in class with any of these students. These are all seniors. What am I doing here? And then the laughter began, and they all laughed and pointed at this silly sleeping boy.
Oh.
And the professor was most filled with laughter and glee, red faced and pointing. And I deserved it, you know, but also maybe I didn't deserve it.
No.
Maybe there's a reason I was sleeping. Not just laziness, but some people take in information differently.
Right.
And he some never people shouldn't go to college.
He never slept again.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet. Well, then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at tmobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
Well, no, I mean, yeah, you're right. That's kind of shitty. To prank a kid and make a kid feel embarrassed in front of a bunch of people, I think they should teach you in teacher's college, don't ever do that. Don't ever humiliate a kid. Like, that's just the, you know, it's just the worst, you know?
Yeah.
And it happened to me a couple times, and it's just like, and I still think about it. It still is like a fucking, you know, finger on a toothache, you know? It's just like, ow.
Yeah.
Every time I think about it. But, you know, you got to remember too, they're high school teachers. There's like, you know, they're, you see them, like I see them with my kids, having, you know, going through high school. I see the teachers that kind of are, you can tell they sort of get off on the fact that they're like pretty cool in relation to these children, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like I'm pretty suave and sophisticated compared to these 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But when it comes to like the lessons and the things that I took from school that I remember, I don't remember any of the actual nuts and bolts, but I do remember when my English teacher was like, look, you're not doing well in this class. Here's what I want you to do so you can get a passing grade. You and Shannon, another actor student in my class, you guys go and do learn this scene from Sam Shepard's play? It was the one with the two lovers that had a tumultuous relationship. Fool for Love.
Okay.
Do a scene from Fool for Love and bring it into class and perform it live. And if you do it well, I'll give you a passing grade in the class. And me and Shannon went and rehearsed at her house this scene. And we rehearsed the hell out of it. And then we came into class and we kicked so much ass. And I was so thrilled with the performance. And then he was like, stay here. I need you to do this performance for the next class that's coming in. He loved it so much. He wanted all of his students to see it. And I just learned so much from that performance. What a great teacher.
Yeah, it was great.
And I, that's a core memory for me. It was a great lesson in how I take in information and how I actually learn on the job so much more than studying it in the book. And that guy, you know, this is a weird name droppy thing. I can't remember his name, but I do remember one thing about this teacher. There was a great English teacher. He was the youngest kid in the Partridge Family. He was that actor.
Oh, wow.
He grew up, and I could look it up on Wikipedia.
I can picture his face, but I can't, you know.
But he grew up and became a great English teacher. But
wow.
And there's a few things like that throughout my schooling where I think about, oh, yeah, but that's where I really learned a lot. Oh.
Brian Forster.
That's the one. Brian Forster. Shout out to Brian. Great teacher.
Great teacher. Yeah. And do you think that part of like, and I'm just curious because is there something about a teacher? Was there something appealing about it? The fact that this teacher took you out of the mainstream and tailored something particularly to you? Like, was that the beginning of what was special about it? Do you think?
I think, he just gave me a chance to communicate a powerful emotion and what great writing can be and what it means to put on a show with great writing. It's it's an essential part of the work. The Sam Shepard thing on the page is one thing, but when you have an actor who's really feeling emotions connected to it, it transforms it into a whole different experience and brings the piece to life in a way that it has to be to experience it properly. You know, like,
yeah,
you can read Shakespeare till the cows come home, but until you see a great performance of it That's the thing, the final essential piece to communicate what's happening inside of it.
Yeah, see, I'm not a big Shakespeare fan.
It's
lost on me. I read it. I've seen it. I've seen real big, great productions of it, and I just don't get it.
I guess you haven't seen Henry the Fifth. Yeah,
I guess that one will change your mind. All right, I'll be right back.
With what's his name? He did a great job.
What's his name?
Yeah, he's a British guy. Come on.
Oh, one of those British guys. Sure.
And he has that speech in there.
Brian Forster.
There's a famous speech in there.
My horse.
St. Crispin's Day.
Oh.
Everyone, we're going into battle. And if you care about forsooth, thy shall say St. Crispin's Day. Something like that.
I get the gist. In the research that somebody else, I don't research this stuff myself. There was something about Anne Bancroft giving you great notes after a high school thing.
That was a big one for me.
Yeah.
So Anne Bancroft's son and Mel Brooks's son together, Maximilian Brooks,
who has been a guest on this podcast.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Because now he's, he wrote all those zombie books. Did you read any of his zombie books? Yeah.
Yeah. He's a brilliant writer.
He's a brilliant writer. And now he's goes around, lecturing and consulting about like disaster, contingencies.
And he's consulted he's consulted by the military about possible scenarios because he's able to creatively imagine horrible things in science fiction future. But also you'll see him sometimes on the Real Time with Bill Maher.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta be ready with Knives Out to go on that show because sometimes Bill will turn on you and you gotta be ready with your shield.
Right.
Because he'll gut you in front of millions. And he has no fear because he can hold his own with anyone on any intellectual level. And I'm very impressed with him.
Right. And he also has the invincible quality of not giving one shit whether you like him or not.
Nope. Yeah.
Like he does not care at all about
We were saying about how powerful it is when you got loving parents that actually really dig you and give you encouragement early on. I have no doubt that he got that from Anne Bancroft because I'm not her son, but
I meant Bill Maher. I was talking about Bill Maher. I thought you were talking about Bill Maher.
Switched.
Oh, you switched. Okay. All right. Because I was like, I didn't mean that about, I'm Max, I think, wants to be liked. And my impression is that it doesn't, he is human and wants to be liked. So, okay.
Yes.
Anyway, Gone with Max and his mom.
No, Bill Maher, I would suggest, has the opposite. He thrives on not being liked. He gets a little charge out of it. He gets a little sexual charge out of it.
Mm.
You don't like what I'm saying and you don't like me? Well, fuck you. And then people love him for it. And there's a
slide whistle. Because he's getting a little bit of wood. A little bit of hate wood.
But so Max Brooks had rad parents who were loving and supporting of him. But beyond that, I was in a play at my high school called The Miracle Worker, famous play. Helen Keller can't see or hear or speak. And she is kind of brought into this world through communication that all the doctors said was impossible by this miracle worker who was played in the movie by Anne Bancroft brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're doing a play of The Miracle Worker, and Anne comes down. She doesn't have to do this because Max is not in the play. She just comes down because, she was in the movie, and she said, "Hello, I heard you were doing this play. I wanted to come and say hi to the cast and tell you all, a little bit about my experience in that movie." And it was just so sweet and wonderful and gave us a little insight as to how we would perform the show. God dang it, I'm getting a phone call. I forgot to do the thing. Let me turn that off and do not disturb.
Was it Biden?
It was Joe Biden, my best friend Biden.
He can wait.
So she comes to the show and is so sweet. And she comes backstage and tells everybody what a great job we all did. And she said, you know, you played the role that everyone said was a thankless little role, a nothing role, and you really brought something to it. And I was like, oh my God, thank you. And then I got home and she had left a message on our answering machine at home. And she said, Jack, I didn't want to say this in front of everyone, but born to do it. You were born to do it. And it was so moving. And I listened to that answering machine message until it wore out the tape cassette. It was like 150 times. And I made a tape of the tape. And it's just weird how sometimes a little word of encouragement can mean so much and take you to another level. Just that boost of self-confidence that I got from that was, I can't really overstate how much it meant to me.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, that's honestly, I bet that's probably why, like, that makes it okay to not go to college, you know? I bet, you know, it's probably like one of those things where you've always got that in the back of your head, you know, because, and also too, when you want to be an actor, college, you know, it's like, I always feel like you learn so much more by doing than studying, and especially in acting, especially in film and television. You can do a million classes, but you learn more from like 3 days on an actual professional set acting and actually learn about what it all really is and how to do it and what's important about it. You learn so much more by just getting paid to do it and being in a professional atmosphere with other professionals, you know.
It's a high wire act and there's tons of adrenaline involved.
Yeah.
And there's no classroom that can really recreate that kind of environment. Yeah, I would go off and do a play with my friends outside of the school in front of real audiences and I grew leaps and bounds and got so much more out of that experience than any of the classes that I had, truth be told.
Throughout, you know, As you progressed in this work, how do you deal with self-doubt? Because it's you know, it's almost like a necessary, you know, accompanying feeling to, like you said, it's a high wire act, and high wire acts involve falls, and there's always a fall that could be right around the corner. Not that high wire acts have corners; it's usually just one straight line. But you get the idea.
Yeah. Self-doubt is a demon that must be faced. And in fact, I get it before every performance, even if I'm feeling real confident about the material or about, you know, the song, if me and Kyle are going to go perform some music somewhere. I just, it's a kind of a running joke that I have with Kyle Gass of Tenacious D. Before we go on stage anywhere, we always, we look at each other with terror and we're like, is there some kind of a loophole? Is there some way we can cancel the show and blame it on something? Blame it on the loophole?
Yeah.
And because no matter how much we love it, there's always that little bit of dread right before you go on stage because there's a fight or flight aspect to performance, to live performance, where you really want that attention and you want that love and you want to put on a good show and make everyone laugh and have a good time. But it also is just a big crowd of people and they could judge you and they could conceivably turn on you. Mm-hmm. And there's always that little tiny seed of fear that you're not going to be accepted and you're not going to be liked. Or, you know, maybe you're even afraid that what if I'm nervous when I go out there? They'll sense my nervousness. It's like they're a big wild animal. If they sense your fear, then they'll kill you.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's irrational. It's like, no, that's just. I have to just remind myself, no matter how bad I think it, like, because you'll wake up someday and you'll get, this doesn't feel like a good day. feels like a bad show day. Feels like today is the day that I go out and shit the bed. No matter how much you feel like it's gonna suck, you have to admit to yourself it's possible that it could go well.
Yeah.
You know what? It's actually possible that I'm gonna go out there and have a great time. As hard to imagine as that is. And then once, if you can like convince yourself that it's possible, not that it's definitely going to be good. That's off the table.
Probably even. No. Yeah. Just possible. If you,
there's a small chance that this could turn out well. And more often than not, it does turn out well. You know, it's just a weird thing that you have to fucking talk yourself into. Isn't that weird? That's why really to do this, you have to love it so much, that feeling of when it goes well, that it's worth all of the anxiety and ulcers and nausea and the nightmares that go along with it, because it ain't easy.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, it is really, really fun. And it is, it's not even, to me, it's more, well, because I got, you know, you're used to like a much more higher energy performance than the things that I've been doing for the last 11 years or so, you know, like going on the Conan show is like, oh, go out there and crack wise. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, I would have bits to act in that I would feel a little charged up about and hope that they went well. But we did so many of those shows that it kind of, we did such a volume business that I was never too precious about any one of them, you know? Mm-hmm. So I got, and I was very, for me too, it's also the place that it's at. If I'm comfortable with the place, I'm comfortable. If it's a new place and new people, then I'm like, oh, fuck. I think I might suck. I think that this has all been a trick on me, like making me believe I can do this. But I do think that I forget what my point was.
I've been waiting for my turn to talk for a second here because
I'm so sorry
that your bits are funny and all of the things that you guys have done over the years have always consistently made me laugh. But the thing that blows my mind about you is you're off the cuff, like cracking wise. Just in the flow, improvisations, or just like things that you'll notice and you'll say. And I always go, man, what a mind. And I'm always blown away by the brilliance of your just in the moment things that you say.
Oh, thank you.
And that can't really be planned for. That just has to be you just actually relaxing in the moment and making observations.
Yeah, yeah. I was on Justin Long's podcast and we talked a lot about it. And it's a kind of not caring that's not the same as not caring. You know, it's like not giving a shit, but it's not not giving a shit. It's giving yourself the freedom to just kind of be in there. And a big thing for me always too was like to pursue my own fun within the moment, like to be myself and to have a good time the way that I wanted to, regardless of all the stuff going on around me. Like I wanted to have fun and I always felt like that was a good sort of MO in order to ensure that the audience would have a good time too. And I mean, it's like why one of my favorite things was when we'd have animals on. Like, just like for me, that was like, yeah, I like doing comedy bits and stuff, but I get to pet a baby tiger, you know, that's the culmination of a lifetime's work is petting a baby tiger, you know, or look at this giant tortoise, you know, like you can touch him and stuff. That's the shit that really mattered to me because I still just like, I really am like, I try and just. I don't know if it's like I try. I just kind of like, I like what I like and I follow what I think is fun. And I think too, what I was going to say was, when you say you got to really like it and to put up with that anxiety, my anxiety isn't so much in that moment. My anxiety is in the larger scheme of how am I going to make a living in all of this? how am I going to sit here when the phone hasn't rung? You know, and I had 11 years of steady work through the last stretch with Conan. So I'm back to that. And that's the part where it's like, yeah, I really do enjoy this because this is stressful. This is stressful, not, you know, like where it's like, well, another day went by where I didn't earn any money, you know, and you're like, you get older, those matter, you know, and so but it's the same thing. It's like, I still love doing this enough that like I'm willing to stick it out. I mean, and at this point, I'm like, what am I going to do? Get a realty license? I don't think so. You know, imagine having to sell realty at this point.
There's always porn.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Someone would pay to see us get it on.
A BBM. Big, beautiful man. Bear stuff. It's always, I remember once, Andy Daly and I went to Disneyland once. We took our daughters when they were little. And we just happened to go on Gay Day. And on Gay Day at Disneyland, everybody was, like all the gay people wear red. And I think I had a red shirt on and I think his daughter had a red shirt on. So people just were looking at like these two blonde men with their two blonde daughters and like, Tons of moms coming at him going, are you putting sunscreen on them? Like, you know, like they just assumed us to be stupid gay dads that don't know how to. But we went to, there used to be this all-you-can-eat barbecue chicken and ribs restaurant that was like, you know, based on, I think, Song of the South. Like, again, that racist, the racist bears, you know. And it was, it's not there anymore. I think that, but. It was like,
that right next to the bears, the country bear jamboree?
And the petting zoo. You know, like, and you know how there's like a little theater up in the woods, you know, kind of by Thunder Mountain Railway?
And the log jammer ride was all was all Song of the South.
Exactly. So it was right there and it was good food and they would just bring you like literal buckets of ribs and chicken. And I saw an entire like table of like 12 bear gay men, you know, big burly gay men, and they were there at like 11:15 a.m. You know, to just power down. And I was like, the efficiency of that, the efficiency of being a big gay dude who just is into big gay dudes, like, yeah, let's go eat four buckets of ribs and like no judgments. We all both are like, oh, it's so fucking hot the way you're putting away those ribs. Yeah, you too, buddy. You know, I was like, oh man, that's the life. That's the life. That is, only.
Yeah, it's a little slice of heaven.
Yeah, yeah.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at tmobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at tmobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
Well, now, with Tenacious D, you guys are so fucking great. Did you ever think, like, okay, it's just going to be the D for me? You know, it's just like acting, schmacting. You know, like, was there ever a point where you're just like, maybe I should just really focus on being in a band?
I've always felt like I needed to do more than just music, and I needed to do more than just acting. I really, from the very beginning, like musical theater, that was the great combo. But no, I've never felt like I want to just do one thing or the other. No. Yeah. I'm too squirrely. I'm more of a jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah.
But we definitely enjoy doing it. But we work in bursts, and we have a slow process. We'll write a record, and we'll tour that record for a couple years, and then we have to take some time off to get that hunger again. We need 6 years between records, so that's just sort of been our process. Yeah. If we had to put out a record like a normal band every 2 years, I don't think we'd still be doing it.
Yeah.
But we do have a plan for another record, and I'm excited for it. But yeah, there will be no D Wine until it's D Time, and I need to get like other gigs going in between those 6 year records to feed the beast inside my soul.
Yeah,
yeah, I need different things, but. I know if I had focused all my powers and energies on Tenacious D, maybe we could have been more successful.
Right. You could have like been like U2.
Exactly. We could have been Pearl Jam.
Yeah. They could have put your album on iPhones, whether you wanted it or not. That is success. You know?
No, I don't think so.
Have you ever done any have you ever done any like Broadway musical theater? Because you have such an amazing voice.
Thank you.
You're such a good singer. Like, you know what's weird? Why doesn't somebody put you in Guys and Dolls or something?
I just realized where I got COVID. Right when you said that. We took a family vacation to New Jersey and New York Broadway, and it was on that trip. At some point, I got COVID. I don't know if it was when I went to see The Music Man starring the great Hugh Jackman, or if it was at the pizza place. We went to John's Pizzeria right afterwards.
Right.
Delicious pizza, by the way.
Yes.
But filled COVID-y. With COVID.
Yeah, COVID-y.
It was somewhere in New York City. Someone sneezed at me. I don't know where and when exactly, but
yeah.
I wouldn't trade it for the world. That was a fun-ass trip. But I ever done Broadway? No, yeah. I've never done Broadway. Broadway. I did off Broadway. I was in a little play based on Bertolt Brecht's poetry that almost no one saw, called Bert Sees the Light.
Mm.
And I have dreams of going on old Broadway. And I was definitely jealous of Hugh Jackman while he was up there. I was thinking, that should be me as the Music Man. We got trouble. And I wanted to do Music Man. I'd always thought, man, Music Man should be my entree to Broadway.
You would be fantastic. Did your wife have to like keep holding your arm and keep you from brushing the stage?
Yes.
I gotta get up there.
Dimmer down, Jack.
Jack, no. Stop it.
And I did enjoy, whenever I see great Broadway musicals, I think, God, that would be a fun life. I saw an incredible production of Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
The Demon Barber of Fleet Street. That's probably my favorite musical theater production or piece that I think has ever been written. That dude was something special. What's his name again? That dude that wrote that?
I don't remember.
Sondheim.
Oh, yeah, Sondheim. Genius. Yeah.
The Demon Barber of Fleet.
I don't know Sondheim that well.
That's the one. I'm going to say that's the one. If you're going to do one, do that one. It's the darkest and the juiciest. Right. And the harmonies are insane.
The murderiest. Yeah.
And you know which other another one I loved? I love The Producers.
Yeah?
The Producers. Yeah. I know it was a movie first. It's kind of cheating because it's not really a musical that came. The real musicals, you want to say, came first, and then a movie was made about, you know, after the stage production. But weirdly, The Producers should have been a Broadway musical first.
Right.
They did the movie, but they should have made it a musical because it works as a musical in a way that the movie doesn't, because the movie is a movie about a musical.
Right.
The musical is a musical about the musical.
About a musical.
And so it works, it resonates stronger on that meta, like, thing within a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of blew my mind. Yes, did I miss Gene Wilder? Of course. And Zero right. Mostel? Of course. No one can replace those guys. But it just kicked so much ass. And I was also just blown away by that Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Because whenever I go, how much life do we really have left? When do you stop rocking?
Yeah.
Can you rock in your 50s? Sure, sure. Yeah. I've seen people rock in their... Can you rock in your 60s? Yeah, barely. Can you rock in your 70s? Nope, it's over.
Yeah,
might as well die at 69.
Yeah.
But then you see someone like Mel Brooks having a fucking fifth act
and
blowing doors down, and then he's like 80 on Broadway. It's inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you meet an old person... that like doesn't act like an old person because you're so used to, and especially like in my own life, all the old people just, most of them suck. They just are like, you know,
they don't,
like the thing to me is they close off, they get more scared. They don't get like more open when it's like, hey man, you know, I get it. That it's scary. The clock is ticking, but try and force yourself open to that. Like, make it so that, like, the end, you're not like, oh, I'm just, you know, like, where you're in the ground before you should be in the ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, but, yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I got to work with Robert Altman, and he was like that. Holy moly, this guy
What did you
so
guys
old.
Do together?
It was a movie called Dr. T and the Women. It's not that great a movie.
You got to hang with Robert Altman.
I did. And he was super friendly, and he like would have dinners at his house. And then I got invited to things in New York because he lived in New York a lot of the time and got to go see screenings and stuff and parties at his apartment. God. And got to go like I got to go to his funeral. I was asked to go to his funeral, and it was a memorial service. And one thing that was really cool about that, and I wish that there was a transcript of it, but Garrison Keillor was one of the eulogizers, and he got up and he talked about Robert Altman's experience as a young man flying bomber planes in the Pacific. And they would take off from somewhere in the Pacific where it'd be 105 degrees, but they'd have to wear those, you know, like sheepskin, those shearling pilot coats, because they'd go up so high that it would be like, you know, 0 degrees. They'd go from 110 to zero. And they flew these deadly missions, I don't remember where like the survival rate was 45%.
Whoa.
And he flew like 20, 30 of these missions at like 20 years old. And so, and made it through. And like a bunch of people died, crash landed a couple times, you know, like barely made it.
Robert Altman did that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and also never talked about it.
Right.
That's not something you know about him.
Didn't toot his horn about it. But what was real is that then he came back to Kansas City and started making industrial films and started smoking weed in people's offices and not giving a fuck about anything, because it's like, motherfucker, you're going to tell me like I can't make this movie the way I want to make it. I looked death in the face at the age of 20 repeatedly. Yeah. And you're going to tell me, like, I can't say fuck, or I can't, like, have nudity, or I can't do this sex scene, or I can't record multiple voices at once, you know, like, and it just, it was just really striking to me and made me feel like, yeah, that's a kind of, he was a hero of mine before, like, you know, artistically. Yeah. And then as I got to meet him, I just was like, this is, you know, and he had his family working for him, like a bunch of people on his kids and different family members worked for him on the set, and they were all capable professionals. But I was like, that's how to do it. Like the way he's
that puts a whole other spin on MASH, the movie that he directed that led to the TV series that ran for years. And is it true? Tell me if this is a trivia thing that you're aware of. That his son wrote the lyrics to the theme song of MASH.
I think he did. I think one of them did, yeah.
And they're not on the TV show. You don't hear any lyrics on the TV show. But
I think he did. Or was it one of the Carradines?
Suicide is painless.
Or was it one of the Carradines? Or is that maybe thinking of that I'm easy? It doesn't matter.
Whatever.
Yeah,
the thing
look it
is,
up, folks.
That... that story blows my mind. And I have a connection to that story because my first movie, Bob Roberts, that I was telling you about, Tim Robbins directed, went to the Cannes Film Festival. And I was not invited because I had such a small part. But my dad lived in Cannes at the time. And I was like, Dad, I'm coming to Cannes to visit you. And then really, I was sneaking into the premiere of Bob Roberts in Cannes Film Festival and had the best time after the screening premiere in Cannes. Tim was like, come, Jack, come to, we're going to the top of the mountain. We're going to have a little after premiere party. And it's nighttime at the top of a mountain in Cannes at some rich guy's mansion. And I'm out on the veranda smoking a joint with Robert Altman, Tim Robbins, and Giancarlo Esposito, who was also.
Wow.
And it was an incredible memory and a moment that I was just like smoking a joint with legends.
Yeah. Yeah. And every night after work, because it was very important to him that everyone watched dailies. So when you were done shooting, and they were very, very like humane hours, you know, like 8-hour days, 9-hour days.
Yeah.
You'd all get together in this big screening room that one of his sons perfected screening rooms, like the right angle and the right projector and the right distance. And we would watch it, and there'd be snacks, and he'd just be smoking joints watching it, you know. Or on weekends, he'd have parties at his house, big, you know, like big dinners for the cast and stuff. And he'd be watching, this was in Dallas, he was in a rental house, and he'd be watching like 6 different football games at once and have money on all of them. And like complicated, like I parlayed the Giants in with the Cowboys. And if the Packers lose, then the Jaguars have to win. And like all these complicated bets, just pursued his own joy.
What an incredible life.
Yeah.
And he was at Cannes because he had directed The Player.
Yeah.
A brilliant movie about the Hollywood industry that Tim was also in.
Tim is in. Yeah.
And, yeah, I always wanted to party with Bob Altman after that. Yeah. And I never got to be in any of his movies. But tragically, he did call me one day, many years later, and said, I think it was like actually 10 years later, or I don't know. He said, I want you to be in a movie. I want you to play this part. It's going to be an adaptation of a documentary that I really love called Hands on a Hard Body. I want to bring that to life in a movie. And I was like, I'm in. And Jack White was going to do all the music for it. And I was like, this is fucking rad. And then he died. And I was so crushed. Not only that, I was not going to be in a fucking Robert Altman movie.
Also
that, you know, this super cool, awesome guy was gone off the planet.
Yeah.
Well, what a life. Yeah. What a crazy life. You know what he reminds me of? And I never met the guy, but did you ever meet that improv?
Del Close?
Yes. The genius Del Close.
Yeah. I took classes with Del.
No shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they am I way off? Did they have any kind of similarities just in energy?
Yes. In energy, yes. But I mean, Del was brilliant and a great teacher and really, you know, thought about improv and was completely devoted to it, but he was a complete mess. You know, he could barely hold together an apartment, you know, whereas
so that's a totally different
thing. Yeah. Whereas Robert Altman, you know, ran movies, you know, and did that, you know, like not only just directed the movie, but like, was constant, you know, like all his movies, he had to go get the money first. He had to go talk to, and I mean, I think the way that everything was done was that he'd go secure, like, because his movies did so much better overseas, that he'd secure all this kind of foreign money and then get the movie started and then be still trying to get money while he's making the movie, you know, like just, like get enough money to start, you know, to get the balloon off the air, but then like to keep fuel in the burner, But you had to keep pushing, you know?
That sounds like chaos to me. Yeah, that sounds an enormous amount of stress and anxiety, but he was able to navigate it because, like I say, he didn't give a shit.
He didn't give a shit, and he had people helping him.
He'll bet the parlay on five different football games, and it sounds like chaos, but no, because he's a brilliant professor, he's able to navigate through, and also, who cares if it all fucking explodes and goes to hell.
It was
and
fun.
And that's what I felt like Del Close was also, even though his life was more shambles, he was like in the middle of a horrible chaos, but he was able to like find some brilliance because he's this wizard professor at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess maybe it's just because they are two old dudes with beards. Maybe that's the only reason I think of them.
Well, no, they're both similar. They're both kind of gurus. They're both kind of visionaries. They're both, you know, very inspirational and inspired a lot of people beneath them. So, yeah, I mean, it is similar.
That's the thing with Del Close that I'm obsessed with is that he's touched so many great performers and yourself included over the decades. I don't know that there's another teacher, certainly of improvisation, that has crossed paths with so many unbelievable talented.
Not in purely an improv comedy. No.
And I don't know that much about him. He never wrote a book. There's not a ton of footage of him. And so he's just this weird, mysterious force of nature that you hear people talk about him, but he's just sort of a mysterious figure in my...
There's somebody made a documentary about him, a guy, a Chicago guy, I can't remember his name. And his business partner, Sharna Halpern, she wrote a book, Truth in Comedy, that was kind of based on all his stuff, you know, and that was kind of like she, but she's sort of like, you know, she kind of literally picked him up out of the gutter and said, you know, here's an apartment, come teach classes. And she kind of, you know, kept him alive to keep him teaching, you know? So, but anyhow, that's none of this is about you.
Sorry.
This is what we're here for. That's all right.
I went off track.
We've been talking a while here. How about the second question? You ready for the second question?
Hit me.
Where are you going? I mean,
No one knows where they're going. No one knows where they're going, first of all, with this question. But, you know, if I had to look into my crystal ball and tell you where I think I'm going, where I'd like to be going, I'd like to watch my boys graduate from high school and follow them and watch where they go on life's journey. And I'm definitely going to worry about them and help them whenever they let me. But I can't help but have anxiety about my boys in the dangerous, strange world ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and I wish for them to have like love and joy and a great adventure. And I know that when I was a kid, I didn't know what life had in store, and I ended up having a incredible, lucky, fun-filled, and, you know, ups and downs. But it's a weird thing. When you have kids, you're like, if there's a crapshoot element where you're like, you want all the great things for them, but you don't know how it's going to go, really. I remember for many, most of my life, I was like, I'm not having kids. It's too much stress. I remember my parents when they got their divorce, it was just like, oh, why would you want to put yourself through all of that turmoil? And
yeah,
it's just easier not to have them. But then at a certain part of my life, I was like, I want to have that in my life. I want to have a family and a sense of shared love and it pulled me into this world that now it's everything to me. And I don't know when it's right to like say, no, let them go on their journey and don't try to control them too much. Because if you try to keep them safe too much, then you're doing them a disservice.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, in the future, where am I going? Yeah.
You never know. I mean, like, I have a 21-year-old son and a 16-year-old daughter. So I'm like a few years... Because your oldest is 16?
Yeah, 16 and 14.
And, well, first of all, with I don't know if you've noticed this, but with the first one, and I even told my son this a few years ago, it's like, listen, everything that we did with you, we had no fucking clue because you're the first. Yeah. Like, we don't know. You know, you're the first one that we had that was like 10. You're the first one that we had that was 12. You're the first one that we had was going to college. You're the first one that drove a car. You know, I don't know. You know, like, how much do I yell at you while we're driving the car and you're fucking up? You know, like, how much do I be quiet and let you learn on your own? You know, and so the first one, you don't know. You know, it's like, I'm sure somebody else made this up, but I heard it first from Kelly Ripa. Like, she said, kids are like pancakes. You know you're going to ruin the first one. I'm dealing with it now where I've talked about it where, you know, you want to make yourself to where your kid doesn't need you. Like, that's your job. It's like to yes. make it so that you're not like you're making an independent creature. So you're trying to avoid their dependence on you as much as you can. But there comes a time when it comes time to where like, oh, he's leaving. And you're like, oh, really? Is that really the deal? No, is that you're going to just go off then. You're just going to go and not be my baby anymore. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's what he's going to do. And it's really hard. And you got to, you know, and then like the, and also you can't do much to ensure one way or the other, you know, they're going to like, if he's going to make mistakes, he's going to make mistakes. If he's going to be like a wildly successful, he's going to do that. And if he's going to, you know, fall on his face, he's going to fall on his face. And all you can do is like be like there to like, I don't know, make dinner for him afterwards, you know, and just, you know, let him watch your cable. Because there's not a lot you can do, and you just have to. Your job, I think, my job, I feel like now I got to fill my life. Like the spaces that were filled with kid and taking care of kid and worrying about kid and you know, raising kid, I got to fill that with something else. I got to figure out something else to put in there. And that's my job rather than just go like, oh, this empty space. Because, I mean, you know. There's definitely, I felt in my life from, you know, like from people, adults that were from when I was a child that were like, oh, the empty space, where are you going? And it's like, well, I thought this was the deal. I thought I was supposed to go out and be on my own. And it's like, yeah, you are. Yeah, you are. And it's not, it isn't fun, but you know, at least you have a band. You know, yeah. How your kids go off and they go to college. You can just go fucking tour with your, you know.
I like to say that when my boys leave the nest, my empty nest is just going to turn into a 24/7 gymnasium. And I'm going to get in the best physical condition of my life.
Sure.
I'm going to finally be able to focus. They're the thing that's getting in the way.
They're the ones holding me back. Yeah.
I'm always eating those snacks that I'm making for them that they don't eat. That's why.
That's why. I got all this shitty food in the house for them. That ice cream, that's for them.
And yeah, there will be another Tenacious D. I think that the Tenacious D thing, there's going to be a Tenacious D album every 6 years until I die. Yeah. And that will happen whether or not there's an audience, even if it ends up just being for ourselves.
Right, because, for the day room at the home.
At the end of the day, we enjoyed doing it. We enjoyed putting on a show for whoever's there, you know, if it's,
do your boys care about show business at all?
They do enjoy partaking in different movies and music that, I'm not really part of. They're not into anything that I'm in anymore.
Yeah. Because
that's just not cool.
No, it isn't.
But I love to watch the things that they get obsessed with. And I'm like, oh, I actually know a couple things about some of those filmmakers. So it's fun to still be able to share. Hey.
I saw that guy puke.
But there's also, I'm going to probably make one more movie. Everything that I'm going to do is just the last one at this point. The future is just, I'm going to do one more thing in each category.
Yeah.
And I look forward to retiring into the retirement home because my fantasy is I'm just going to play video games all day.
Yeah.
Because I never play as much video game. I don't hardly play video games at all anymore because I always feel like, who has time? I got to get all these things done. I do look forward to the time when, no, I don't have to get anything done.
Yeah.
I'm in the home and I'm just playing Red Dead Redemption Part 7. Maybe that's not going to happen, but that's my fantasy. And I bet you there's going to be a lot more video games in the coming years as we come to the generation, the video game generation.
Right. You'll just plug right into your neck and then you won't even have a controller. You'll just be laying like a puddle of sauce, you know, playing a video game in your mind.
Well, you remember that movie that Robert De Niro and what was it?
Kaylee Cuoco.
Forget it. No, where they had the old folks home and they only responded to when you played music that they enjoyed in their 20s.
No, I don't remember.
Okay, forget it. Anyway, that's what I'm. Thank you, Awakenings.
Matt just put that in the chat.
That's going to be what it's like for me. That I'm totally catatonic until
they put on Dio.
You put on Dio and a screen with Asteroids, the video game. And I'll be like, I'll be reactivated.
Let me add it. Yeah.
The future. Well, who the hell knows about the future?
I know. Well, what have you learned? That's the third question. I just slid right.
This is the hardest one. What have I learned?
Yeah.
When I was thinking about it last night.
It doesn't have to be profound. I mean, Padgett Brewster, one of hers was, you can sharpen scissors by cutting tinfoil. Which I was that's pretty good. You know,
and it does
work.
That.
I tried it. And
that's
it does
a great
work.
Thing.
Yeah.
That's a great thing. I learned the mantra before going on stage or going out in front of an audience. This is going to sound like bad advice. Always remember to pretend to have a good time. And then oftentimes that'll lead to good stuff when you're out there. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to be having a good time. But if you can pretend to like be enjoying yourself, sometimes it'll lead to actually enjoying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That helps me to stay out of the vortex of terror.
Yeah. That's a pretty good one too. And I mean, and it's a kind of a, kind of a Norman Vincent Peale positive attitude, but it's, you know, it is true. It's, I remember, you know, I was directing a television commercial for Illinois Lottery and they had, and that I was in too, but they had a guy from the Blackhawks, a hockey player off to the side, reading some copy for some B-roll kind of stuff for the lottery. And they said, they pulled me over because I was doing something else. And they're like, he's reading this copy. It was like an agency guy. And he goes like, it's just not very lifeful. It doesn't have a lot of life to it. And I went and I listened to him read it once. And I said, smile while you say it. And he, because it was just going to be voiceover, like at the end of the commercials. And they were just doing it off on the side of the studio. And which is like something that, you know, I'd learned in doing voiceovers. But when you smile, it makes you sound a lot more upbeat. And he did it, and it sounded great. You know, and like it just, like you put a big fake grin on your face when you're reading something, and it just makes it sound better. You know, it just makes it sound more upbeat. And it's, that's kind of like, in a microcosm, like, that's make it till you fake it. That's like, you know, that's like, just put a smile, like smile while you say it. And just, and I mean, granted, yeah, I don't mean be a Pollyanna and let bad things happen. But I mean, you know, but like just kind of in your regular life, if you're feeling like it's a little flat, you know, smile while you say it. And then that also isn't like the gross kind of like, come on, honey, put on a smile for me. You know, I don't mean it like that. You know, it just means like, yeah, you can kind of fake it till you make it. You can kind of force a good feeling. You know, like out of just will. And maybe you don't, but it's better than just succumbing to the darkness, you know?
100%.
Yeah.
And you only have to fake it for a second, and then all of a sudden it turns into real joy.
Frequently, okay. Yeah. Well, you give a lot of joy. I love you so much. I mean,
feelings mute.
Just so much stuff that I see, like when you, the stuff you put on Instagram, I mean, Instagram is Instagram. It's like, it's infuriating me to me most of the time. I just like sort of rage scroll Instagram most of the time. but like you do so much fun stuff that is just pure fucking joy. And it's really such a service. And I'm so grateful for your presence in the universe. And especially for your presence here, man. It's really great.
Oh, my God. I mean, it was a no-brainer. When I got the call to be on your show, I was like, this is happening. As soon as I get a window, I'm going in.
Thank you. Because
from the beginning, I've always loved your work, and then always loved hanging with you over the years. We've had lots of times where we've crossed paths.
Yeah.
And it was awesome to share this day, this podcast with you. And feel free, dude, seriously, feel free. Cut out all the parts where I was boringly rambling too long.
No.
Trim it.
We're going to cut out the interesting stuff.
Just fully lipo out all.
Yeah. It'll be me asking questions and you going,
Do it. Whatever you feel awesome. Is right.
All right. Well, thank you, Jack. And thank all of you out there for listening. I'll be back next week with another person. Not as good as Jack Black, though.
You say that to all the podcasters.
Big love for you.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
This has been a Team Coco production.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet?
Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.